There's a well-known story about a famous producer of television news in the United States that intended a Yom Kippur night, the Kol Nidre service, at a certain congregation, and the rabbi delivered a 45-minute sermon on the importance of repentance and holiness. After the service was over and everyone was lining up to wish the rabbi well, the producer came over to him and he introduced himself. He said, "You know, I'm the producer of this wonderful news show. Rabbi, do you think that you could condense your sermon into 3 minutes?" So the rabbi, who had visions of being on national television and becoming a very famous person, thought about it, and he said, yes, I could do so. So the man said, "Then why didn't you?" So the question here is, what have we learned from history? And the answer is nothing. But there are patterns in Jewish history, in Jewish life, that recur often, and I'd like to speak about those patterns, and I think we can identify with many of them. The first topic has to do with acculturation and assimilation. The Jewish people, having been in every culture and place in the world, subject to all of the influences of all of the different civilizations, naturally have become acculturated in every place that they exist. They take on the trappings of the culture, no matter how isolated they wish to be, but it is almost impossible not to become acculturated. So we become acculturated in dress. Much of the Haredi world today dresses according to the culture of the Polish noblemen in the 18th and 19th centuries. I remember that in the early 1980s, when the Soviet Union was starting to totter, so the Kremlin sent an exhibition of treasures from the Kremlin around the world to raise money. And it was exhibited in the New York Metropolitan Museum. And so I went to see it, and I was impressed because I saw the Schreimel of Peter the Great. Except that he had a golden cross on top, but otherwise, it was exactly what the garb that you can see in the Hasidic circles. That's a sign of acculturation. Language, you take Yiddish, for instance. So Yiddish is a corruption of a form of German, mixed in liberally with Hebrew, with Polish, with Russian. Today it's with English. It's a jargon that's composed of many different cultures. And that became the Jewish language, even though, with the exception of Hebrew, none of the original languages that composed it were Jewish. And you'll find acculturation in the Talmud, in the Mishnah. There's a great deal of Greek, afikoman, good Greek word. Many other words in the Mishnah are Greek. The Jews, when Alexander the Great came to visit the Holy Land in 325 before the Common Era, and he spared the city of Jerusalem from destruction, so the Jews agreed then that as a gift to him, they would name all male children born in that year Alexander. And that's how the name Alexander, Sender, that belt became a Jewish name. Well, once Alexander became a kosher name. So we find the different names in the Talmud, Aristobulus, which also was a name of a Maccabean king. All of that came into Jewish life. In fact, the Eben Ezra says that the name Moshe, of Moshe Rabbeinu, is an Egyptian name, not a Hebrew name. It's interesting how he got the name. You know, rabbis never stick to the topic, so don't get nervous. God sees Moshe. Moshe is, the dream of every Jewish young man. He's working for his father-in-law. And he's a shepherd. And he comes by and he sees a burning bush. The bush is burning. The Kotzker Rebbe says everybody saw the burning bush, not just Moshe, but they, it was burning yesterday too. It was burning 2 days ago. But I'm busy. I got carpool. I got to go to the supermarket. I have no time to look. Moshe says, Asuranov Eres Amare Agodol Azeh Madu Alo Yivar Asneh. I'm going to stop. How come the bush is not consumed? How come that it burns and burns and burns is not consumed? So it says in the Torah, Vayar Hashem Kisor Liros. God saw that somebody stopped. Moshe is not ordained that he's going to, he stopped. So the angel of the Lord speaks to him and he calls out to him, Moshe, Moshe, come here. I got a job for you. Wow. So the rabbis all ask, why did he call him Moshe if that's his Egyptian name? He had Hebrew names, Avigdor, Yered, Tovia. The rabbis list seven Hebrew names that he had, beautiful names. So he calls him what, Jeffrey, Eric, Kevin, what? Where did he get that? The rabbis say a tremendous insight that all of us should feel, which is part of the pattern of Jewish history. Why was he called Moshe? Because the daughter of the Pharaoh, when she saved him, called him Moshe. Ki min amayim mishisihu. I have drawn him forth from the waters. And again, the Eben Ezra says that that word, the verb, is also an Egyptian verb. Moshe doesn't want the job. Who wants the job? I had a good friend of mine when I was a rabbi in Miami Beach. He was a reform rabbi. We were across the street from each other, but he was a real good guy. And we had a lot of good conversations. So he said to me, well, what kind of congregation do you have? I said, I have a congregation full of Jews, so there are problems. So he said to me, I got the greatest congregation in the world. They're all non-Jews. So Moshe doesn't want the job. He says, Shlach no biyad tishloch, send somebody else, my brother, send somebody else. I'm the only guy in the world. I once stopped a Jew in Jerusalem and asked him for directions. He said, there are 300,000 Jews in Jerusalem. You got to stop me? Well, send somebody else. So God says to him, Moshe, that's your name. Ki min amayim mishisihu. I took you out of the crocodiles. Don't tell me send somebody else. I saved you. If I saved you, you owe me. All of us are saved. All of us are survivors. They meant all of us 70 years ago. And to a certain extent, they mean all of us today too. We're all saved. We're all taken out of the water. So you can't just say, send somebody else. You know, I don't want to be bothered. I don't want to give. I don't want to be identified. Because our name is Moshe. Kiminamayim Mishisiyu. We are drawn forth from the waters to serve our destiny and our mission. So Jews have always been acculturated. We always had the foreign culture that surrounds us. But on the other hand, Jews have fought enormous struggles not to assimilate, not to give in, not to lose their Jewish identity. My Rebbe in the yeshiva long ago told us, he said, well, if your grandparents are proud of you and your grandchildren are proud of you, then you're probably all right. And that has been the measure of Jewish life. What do my grandparents think of me? Now, what will my grandchildren think of me since I became a grandfather? Now, thank God, a great-grandfather, you know, I started to behave myself. Because I want them to have a good opinion of me. Because after all, that's all I'm going to leave them. That's all I am, is the memory of what I was. So we have fought not to become assimilated. And where that line is drawn between acculturation and assimilation is a shifting line, depending upon countries, nations, civilizations, times, generations. There's no hard and fast rule. But the pattern is there, and everyone has to look into the pattern. I had a good friend of mine who owned a mortgage company in Memphis, Tennessee. You know, the Lord has arranged his things. It so happens that this good friend, his granddaughter, his great-granddaughter, rather, is going to marry my grandson, which was something that neither of us imagined, and neither of us could have afforded. Anyway, he owned a mortgage company. And he became, in Memphis, Tennessee, he became more and more observant. And then finally he decided that the mortgage company not only is closed on Saturdays, it's closed on all Jewish holidays as well. And this mortgage company, he was the representative for New York Life Insurance Company, one of the largest insurance companies in the United States, and he was their agent to place their mortgages, to service their mortgages in three or four of the southern states of the United States. It's a very big client, and it's a very profitable business. So it came out the first year that he's going to close his office on Yom Tov, on the holiday. So it came out that Rosh Hashanah was Monday and Tuesday. So Sukkot was Monday and Tuesday, and Shmini Atzeres and Simchas Torah was Monday and Tuesday. So he's going to be closed 6 business days within 3 weeks. So he called up the parent office in New York, and he spoke to the vice president of the company, and he said, by the way, we're closed Monday and Tuesday. And he's going to be closed Yom Kippur. So he's closed 7 days, 7 business days. So the vice president says to him, New York Life Insurance Company cannot afford that its mortgage offices should be closed 7 business days in 3 weeks. So he said, it's my holidays, it's my faith. So the vice president said to him, well, we'll have to reconsider. Maybe we'll get a different agent. So he said, well, you know, you have to do what you have to do, and I have to do what I have to do. So there were two brothers in the business. So the other brother said, you know, we can't afford to lose them. Let's call another rabbi. Because we all know that there's always another rabbi, whichever way you want to go. And he said no. Sam said, no, we're going to be closed, you know. And he said, we made a living before New York Life, we'll make a living without New York Life. And they're closed. The day after Simchas Torah, he gets a call from the vice president of New York Life. He says, Sam? He said, yeah. He says, this is, you know, so-and-so. And so he expects fully that they're going to drop him. So he says, you know, I flew down to Memphis. And I was there Monday and Tuesday. He said, by God, your office was closed. He said, that's the kind of people we want to represent us. Someone that is that loyal to his faith, we know you're the one that we want us to run. They became extremely wealthy from it. That doesn't always work, but that's a line between acculturation and assimilation. And because we could find in halacha, we could find a heter somehow, non-Jews had worked there, we'd give them a share of the business, they'd be open, there's a way. But that already starts the slippery slope, which leads to assimilation. You know, intermarriage in the Jewish world always was relatively insignificant. Not so much because of the Jewish part, but because of the non-Jewish part. A non-Jew didn't want to marry a Jew. It was a stigma if you had Jews in your family. But in our world, where the Vice President of the United States has a Jewish son-in-law now, and where Clinton has a Jewish son-in-law, and where Carolyn Kennedy is married to a Jew, and where it's completely acceptable. So if the non-Jews will have us, so then it's a matter of personal decision. It's not a question anymore that they won't have you. And therefore, the road to assimilation and to intermarriage is wide open. And unless one has convictions, unless one understands why one is Jewish, I have heard from many Holocaust survivors that in the camps, they said there were Jews that had faith and they had some understanding of what they were doing there, how they got there. But he said there were people that were completely assimilated, people that had no connection to Judaism whatsoever, and they never understood what they were doing there. So their tragedy was doubled. Another pattern that exists in Jewish history is the relationship to the land of Israel. A very complicated relationship. Almost a love-hate relationship. It begins in the Sedra of the week that we just read on Shabbat. These righteous leaders of Israel come back and they give such a negative report about the land of Israel. And everything they said was true, except the spin that they put on it was not true. The objective facts were true. And because of that, the Jewish people said, okay, we're not going to the land of Israel, we're going back to Egypt. Remember, we saw before, they said, oh, in Egypt, it was terrific, you know, we had pickles to eat, watermelon. It was great. They forgot that they took their children and mortared them into the bricks. So that whole generation dies out. So there has to be a generation that cannot go back to Egypt, that doesn't remember Egypt, that doesn't have an Egyptian passport. And that has to be the generation that goes to the land of Israel. So they go almost coerced because they have nowhere else to go. And they come to the land of Israel. So one would think that God would be more hospitable to us. You come to the land of Israel, everybody would welcome you. You know, there'd be a Kiddush on Shabbos. Well, you know, you made Aliyah, terrific. Instead, it's 7 years of war, 7 years till they divide up the country, and then there's almost 400 years of constant strife. You think we have trouble now? Read the book of Judges, Sefer Shoftim. Constant strife. And there's civil war between the tribes. They can't get their act together until finally the prophet Samuel, King Saul, King David, King Solomon are able to build a country. And the temple is built, and that's the zenith of Jewish history. But it doesn't last long. It deteriorates immediately. Now the first temple is destroyed. The Jews go into exile. They're in Babylonia. They get a decree from King Cyrus, Koresh. You can go back. It's the Balfour Declaration. Go back. Ezra gets up and he says, let's go. There are about 700,000 Jews in Babylonia. 42,000 go with him. And the 42,000 that go with him are not from, let us say, the upper class. They're not the pious Jews. They're not the scholars. All of those stayed in Babylonia. The Talmud says that if a person came from Babylonia, his pedigree automatically was accepted. But who came with Ezra? So the Gemara, the Mishnah in Gedushin lists, the slaves came, Mamzerim came, Shtuki, Asufi, all kinds of questionable people. And he builds the second temple with them. And now the majority of the Jewish people don't live in the land of Israel. And Ezra, if we read it in the book, Ezra and Nehemiah are frustrated beyond belief because they have the opportunity and nothing happens. And therefore, even though the second temple is built, the rabbis tell us that they felt it was doomed from the beginning. All throughout Jewish history, on one hand, the Jews want the land of Israel, and they want to go back to it. On the other hand, they're ambivalent towards it. They don't know how to deal with it. It's the greatest challenge in national Jewish life. I think we heard some of that last night from Dr. Kedar. How do you build a Jewish state? It's easier to build a Jewish community, let's say in Brooklyn, you know, so the state of New York provides the police and they provide it. You don't have to do any, you know, you're living there. But when you've got to provide the police and you've got to provide the taxes and you've got the parliament and you have all that political mess and you have security and army and how do you do that? And that's a challenge. That's a great challenge. Moshe Rabbeinu said to God, Rei ato omer elai ha'les om hazeh. You tell me I'm supposed to uplift this people. I'm supposed to make them a great people. Ve'ato lo hodotani, and you didn't ever told me how. How am I supposed to do it? Moshe will say, you know, Eicho Esau Levadi, Torchachem, Asachem, Verivchem. How can I bear it? There are a bunch of nudniks that bother me. Yeah, I used to, when I was with the OU, so I had a mashgiach in Hawaii and the Dole Pineapple. So he would call me 3 a.m, I'm in bed. And he would call me and he would say, I didn't want to bother you in the office. Yeah, so you're supposed to make a people out of this. You didn't tell me how. And nowhere in the Shulchan Aruch does it say how to run a state. Nowhere in the Shulchan Aruch does it say what you're supposed to do, what's your diplomacy, what's your policy, how do you make peace, how do you make war? It doesn't say. You only tell me that you have to do it. You have to raise these people. You have to make them great. You have to fight it through. And we're in the process. So therefore, there are a lot of naysayers in the Jewish world regarding a Jewish state. It's more comfortable for everybody if, God forbid, there would be no Jewish state. Every Jew in the world would be more comfortable, right? Wouldn't bother us. We're not interested that every day to look in the paper and see us. You know, and the United Nations is going to have a session next September. Guess what they're going to talk about? We're the only problem in the world. You know, Syria, he can kill 15,000 people. It's no problem. Egypt is falling apart. No problem. But, you know, there are Palestinians that are stopped at a checkpoint to see whether they're carrying a knife or a gun. That's a problem. That defies human rights. So we're uncomfortable because we're all in favor of human rights. We'd like to be the nice guys in the world. And the land of Israel always paints the Jewish people into a corner. And God wants to see what we look like there. And Shlomo HaMelech says in Shir HaShirim, Harenius Marayich, Hashminius Kolech. Let me see what you look like. Let's hear your voice. So the rabbis say, the Medrash says, that the parable here is that the Jewish people are like a dove perched on a ledge. They can't go into the ledge because there's a snake waiting there. They can't fly out into the open because the hawk is circling above them. And then God says to us, so now let's see what you're made out of. That's our goal. That's our destiny. That's the pattern in Jewish history. Let's see what we're made out of. Because if it were easy to be a Jew, I guess there'd be more of us. I heard from Rabbi Feinstein many times, he would say, you know, in Yiddish there was a phrase, Schwer zu sein Jid. It's hard to be a Jew. So he used to say, yes, but it's harder not to be a Jew. We're the great drama in human civilization. We're the longest running play on Broadway. We're always on. And it's interesting, in the Jewish world, there is no audience. Everybody's an actor. Everybody's part of the cast. And the Lord told us, you know, that we're at the time of the destruction of the temple, there were about 7 million Jews in the world. It's almost 2,000 years ago. So to put that into perspective for you, there are about 13, 14 million Chinese in the world then. Today there are 1,600,000,000 Chinese, and we're about 14, 15 million people. Well, if there'd be 1,600,000,000 Jews in the world, First of all, there wouldn't be an undeveloped piece of real estate left on the globe. The Amazon forest would long ago have been destroyed. But if there'd be that many Jews, nobody would do anything, you know? It wouldn't be up to me. The story is told that there was a town that had 10 male Jews. Every day they had a minion. Then the guy had a cold, everybody came, nobody went on vacation. They always had a minion. And then the Lord helped that an 11th family moved into town. The next day there was no minion. So God told us in advance, Lo merubchem, I did not choose you because you would be many, it says in the Torah. Ki'atem amat mikol ha'amim, you'll always be the fewest of all people. I mean, we make noise like who knows how many millions there are. And go tell him you can't get a minion from Mincha Maariv. Nobody here, just us. This is, you know, this is South Africa here. So all of us are on stage. All of us are part of it. And therefore, if we all feel that we're part of the cast, so then we approach the matter much differently. We have a greater sense of responsibility and of destiny. And then finally, one other pattern that I want to discuss has to do with the moral, social thrust of the Jewish people. The Jewish people have always been the utopian section of humanity. We believe we gave the world the idea of the Messiah. That's one of the famous statements of the Rambam. We gave the world the idea that there could be world peace, that people could get along, that there'll be a day that you won't have to have military academies, that the swords can be beaten into plowshares. That's us. That's our vision. That's our utopia. Because of the fact that we're utopians, so the pattern has always been that Jews are suckers for all utopian ideas. Marxism, which dominated the Jewish world in the 19th and part of the 20th century, you know, out of the first Politburo of Lenin, 19 members, 7 were Jewish. 2 had smicha to be rabbis. Because that was utopian. Comes the revolution, everything's going to be good. The only thing is that it never came. 80 million people got killed, and the great new world never showed up. But Jews believed that it would. Jews believed in it as a religion. So the most atheistic Jew is religious because that's his religion. His religion is utopianism. And because of that, many things happen in the Jewish world that seem strange, that seem to be almost anti-Jewish. But nevertheless, are part of the Jewish experience simply because of this bent towards utopianism. Golda Meir, when she was prime minister of Israel, so she was a doctrinaire socialist. She really believed. And so she would attend the socialist conferences that were held throughout the world. And she was the prime minister in the 1973 war, the Yom Kippur War, when Israel, for about 4 days, tottered at the verge of extinction, God forbid. The Syrian army was had a clear path to Haifa. The Egyptian army had broken through in the Sinai. The Israeli army had run out of ammunition. We were dependent upon Nixon and Kissinger. And she appealed to all of her socialist colleagues for socialist solidarity. And she writes in her memoirs that that was the turning point in her life when she realized that she was a Jew and not a socialist. And that's how the socialists viewed her. So this pattern exists throughout Jewish history. So Jews are liberals first and Jews second. They're feminists first and Jews second. They're environmentalists first and Jews second. Whatever current idea takes hold, that's what it is. But we are supposed to be Jews first. And all the other ideas are part of the acculturation. If they're good ideas, we should adopt them. If they're not good ideas, we should reject them. But that doesn't define us. There's no ism that defines us, that says who we are. The Lord told us, Ve'atem tiyuli mamleches kohanim v'goy kodosh. You will be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That's your job. That's your definition. But again, he didn't outline exactly how we get there. And times change, circumstances change, technology certainly changes. And there is no one size fits all. But the mission, the goal, the definition of who we are, that has never changed. That pattern has remained constant in Jewish life. And therefore, if we see it in that fashion, and we are willing not only to accept it, but we're willing to advance it and be proud of it, to tell our children that. I always mention there's a session on parenting, so I don't want to mix into it, but I always mention that in our family, we never told a child, you know, it is forbidden. We used to say, our family doesn't do this. That's not the way our family behaves. And that's the sense of family, of who I am, of who my grandfather was. You know, my grandfather passed away, so I heard my aunt and my mother discussing the fact that I was an only child, so I was an adult from birth. So they were discussing the fact that my grandfather had an insurance policy for $10,000. In 1944, $10,000 was a lot of money. So they already agreed that they would have money to send me to college and my cousin to college and everything. So they sent the papers away to the insurance company, and the insurance company sent them back a letter, and they said my grandfather had borrowed $9,800 against the policy, and that the check was made out to the Vod HaHatzola, to the organization of Orthodox rabbis in the United States that saved 100,000 Jews from the Holocaust by defying the American government and bribing the Germans. So I've often thought, if I had the I can spend $10,000 in a minute. So the $10,000 would have been gone. But this way I have my grandfather. And there are a lot of moments in life when one is lonely and when money can't really help us. But if we have our grandfathers, if we have our tradition, if we have our self-worth and our self-definition, if I know who I am, So then we are very wealthy people. And we have a treasure that we can pass on to the next generation, and they to the next generation. This is the way our family behaves. From Sinai to Sinai in Daba, this is the way our family behaves. And that is the pattern in Jewish history, and that is what makes us the people who have a vision of being a Mamleches Kohanim v'goy Kadosh. Thank you.